Welcome to Our Hen House. This is Jasmine Singer.
And this is Marianne Sullivan.
Thank you so much for joining us this week. Marianne's guest this week is one of our very favorite people, Mark Hawthorne. He's joining us once again to talk about his latest book, The Way of the Rabbit, which is a lovely, informative, and basically charming book about, well, yeah, you figured it out, about rabbits. If you thought you knew rabbits, forget about it. You almost certainly have a lot to learn.
Yeah, I love this. Well, I love Mark so much, and I love this interview. It was a real change of pace. So on the Flock bonus segment, Mark's going to be treating you to a reading from The Way of the Rabbit. And as always, if you're a Flock member, you'll get that link to the bonus segment in your email on the Tuesday after this podcast episode goes up. You can always find it on the Flock Facebook group. And if you're not a member of the Flock and you can afford it, you can join for $10 a month at ourhenhouse.org/donate.
Oh, and also, if you're a member of the Flock, please join us for our Flock First Friday Zoom calls, which are once a month on the first Friday of the month at 4 p.m. Eastern or 8 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, where we focus on how to be better activists and how to take care of ourselves. And we speak to some really cool guests. So if you're a member of the Flock, check out the Flock Facebook group for updates or write to us at info@ourhenhouse.org. And you can also set up one-on-ones with me, too, if you want, and you're in the Flock, and you want to talk about your activism or your veganism or anything related to changing the world for animals. Email Jen to sign up, jen@ourhenhouse.org. So, speaking of rabbits, there are so many rabbits in and around this new home that I'll be moving to, like, all over the place, all over the street, the lawns. So many rabbits, and I love it. Like, they're so cute. But it's also a little scary to drive, you know? So I, like, drive less than 1 mile an hour. If someone was slowly walking beside me, they would get to wherever they're going more quickly than me.
Yeah, and rabbits are pretty fast, so hopefully they can get out of the way. But I agree, it's scary. But it's one of the exciting things about moving into a new house, and congratulations on moving into your new house.
Thank you.
All of a sudden, there's wildlife. Like, it is home to so many little creatures who have been there far longer than you have. Well, I know that there's a lot for you to think about right now, like a billion things to think about with the house. But one of the things to think about is, yeah, how best to share that land with animals.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I have owned a home before, but not for, like, it was a very short amount of time. Mostly I've been in apartments in big cities. But this is different because a lot of the impetus for moving up to Rochester is the climate and all of the things that go with climate change, including, to me, part of that is A, our daily choices. I mean, you know, hashtag go vegan. And B, taking care of the animals who are our neighbors because they need us to take care of them. So it is not really my yard when I think of it that way. You know, it's sort of like it's a yard for whoever happens to need it, whichever wild animal happens to need it. Not that it's a very big yard, but I'd like to be very conscious about the way that I treat it and the food that I grow and how to make it more wildlife friendly, which actually you know a lot more about than I do.
Well, I would say I know a lot about it. I did really, really love the interview that I did with Nancy Lawson, who wrote The Humane Gardener. I think that was back on episode 498. And I read that book, and I highly advise that book to anyone who's taking care of some land on ways to make it more friendly for the animals. And yeah, you mentioned food to grow. Like, I just don't know whether I want a garden at all. You know, I'm not really very diligent about taking care of things. And I would hate to, like, garden and feel like I had to close out the animals, but you definitely do. You definitely have to be in a little bit of competition with the animals when you garden. So, yeah, I don't know whether I'm even going to do that, but, you know, it might be a nice idea to grow some food. And the other really important feature, I think, which I also learned from doing the podcast, and this is something we're both going to have to look into, is to get to know your local rehabbers, because the worst time to be looking for a rehabber is the moment when you find an injured animal in your backyard and you're panicked and it's really hard to get a hold of them and you don't know how to look them up. And And the episode that I did that had to do that with that was, of course, with Rita McMahon from the Wild Bird Fund in New York City, which is a huge rehabbing facility. It makes things so easy if you live in New York City because they don't take just birds. They are mostly for birds. But I can remember back in the day when I lived in the city and there was nobody and it was really hard to find them. So I want to look into that as soon as possible. I also always have dreams of becoming a rehabber, but I know that's one of those dreams that is probably not going to come true because I don't think I have the stuff, but
I don't know.
I think about it.
Yeah, I bet a lot of people who do whatever they do in the world, whether it's podcasting or rehabbing, you know, we tend to look at them as like, oh, they have that skill, or oh, they have those resources. But really, all that it's about is just doing it. So I would not be so quick to say you can't. I mean, if we were going to think like that, I could just say that about gardening. I can't garden worth shit. And I'm
worried.
Well,
I kind of do say that about gardening.
Well, yeah, but like the point is we have sort of, in my opinion, like a moral responsibility to turn the land that we have into some kind of a haven for animals in whatever way is possible.
Oh, I totally, when I said gardening, I meant gardening food for me. I totally agree that we should do everything we can to turn land into havens for animals. It's just that sometimes that doesn't always coordinate with growing food. But yeah, I shouldn't be using gardening so narrowly. You know, I watch gardening shows all the time. I don't know why. It's like, I don't garden. I just watch gardening shows and it kind of satisfies me. But the ones I love the most are the people who garden for the animals, like who just are growing things to make, you know, habitat for wild animals. That just seems so satisfying to me and so important nowadays because, of course, animals' habitat is just being destroyed. I mean, when you think of the animals who have lost their homes because of these unbelievable wildfires and in the West and in Siberia. I mean, like, we're driving animals off of the world. So every opportunity we have with any land we own, I think is a good idea to be making it more friendly to animals.
I totally agree. When I was in West Hollywood, we just had this tiny little balcony. And there was like we got a little bird feeder for it and the birds, you know, immediately loved it. And then there was this squirrel who sort of overtook it. And I don't really know how to deal with that kind of thing, but I'm just going to take it one bird feed seed at a time and figure it out.
Well, the one way not to deal with it, I think, is just to not hate the squirrels. That's what so many people do. Like, they favor one kind of wildlife and then hate the other kind. I mean, there's a place for everybody.
Yeah, no, obviously, I just need to know more. And in this particular scenario, I was dealing with one small bird feeder. And the issue was that the squirrel would come and basically shake the whole thing. So all of the bird seed would go all over the whole balcony and then down to the courtyard, which was beneath the balcony. And there was no seed left for the birds. And the birds had already been like, hey, you guys, there are these vegans who live at this apartment and they have a bird feeder. Let's go. And then they would come and there would be nothing left for them. So like, I couldn't manage it. I wound up moving the bird feeder to the pond, the little man-made pond that was in the middle of the courtyard. It still happened, but I felt like maybe it was a little better of a situation since there was more space. And if the seed was scattered, the birds would be able to eat it. But anyway,
it also brings up the whole question, which, you know, if you go online, you get confused about everything. And I got really confused about bird feeders. Like, are they good for birds? Do they get addicted to them? Do you, like, then if you have to stop, if you move or something, are they, you know, they have a pattern that they run around every day and they go to certain places where they can get food. So what happens if you take one of those sources away from them? And some people say you shouldn't use bird feeders. Some people, I think most people say they're okay, but particularly in the winter, you should be very careful not to just stop because they really do depend on it. At other times of the year, they don't depend on it as much as everything gets so complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
So the other thing I want to think about is having bee hotels. Mm. You can either buy them or make them, but like with tiny little teeny weeny little habitats for bees, because most bees do not live in hives. The vast majority of bees do not live in hives. They live individually. I think 30%, I looked this all up for this podcast, 30% of bees live in, you know, in little crevices like that. So you're really helping them out. Those are not aggressive bees. You know, I don't think they're incapable of stinging you, but it's very unlikely that they will sting you. And so that's a great way to provide habitat for bees. The other thing that it's important to know is that honeybees, which we think of as like all of the bees, or at least I did because I don't know anything about bees. Like, they're not native. They don't even come from here. They can actually, in certain circumstances, be, you know, kind of displace native bees, which is really bad. So most bees do not live in hives. There are bumblebees, Native American bees, that live in hives. And I'm sorry for our international listeners. I'm talking about, you know, the U.S. for now. You can have your honeybees because they're native for you, or they're native somewhere, I think in Europe. You know, I don't know how you help the bees who don't live in crevices. I think the thing I read said that they live in, like, they dig holes in the ground. That seems so unlikely to me. But this is my very, very limited knowledge of bee habitats. But bee hotels are very cool, because if there's one thing that we all really need to be doing, it's encouraging pollinators. And bees are terrific pollinators. And it'll help your garden, and it'll help out the bees.
Well, I love it. Well, I'm excited about chatting with Mark today, because he is a longtime rabbit lover who has fostered and rescued so many bunnies over the years, seven of whom he adopted. These house rabbits became part of the inspiration for Mark Hawthorne's latest book, The Way of the Rabbit, which he describes as an affectionate history of nature's most surprising species. Mark is also the author of three books on animal rights and social justice, A Vegan Ethic, Embracing a Life of Compassion Toward All, Bleeding Hearts, The Hidden World of Animal Suffering, and the best-selling Striking at the Roots, A Practical Guide to Animal Activism, which was updated as a 10th anniversary edition in 2018. Mark has been an ethical vegan for 20 years, and he is a frequent contributor to Veg News. He also volunteers with the Vegan Food Justice Group Food Empowerment Project, which is, of course, headed up by his wife, Laura Nornellis. Mark is also just happens to be one of the nicest humans you'll ever meet, and he'll be joining Marianne right after this.
If you like what you're listening to, and I hope you do, then please consider taking a minute out of your day today to leave us a friendly review. You can do it on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or Stitcher or on Facebook or wherever you listen to podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. The more we get out there, the more our henhouse will be in front of people's eyeballs when they're putting in search terms in their podcasts, and the more we could join forces together to elevate the voices of the animals and change the world for them. So thank you so much in advance for leaving us a friendly review.
Welcome to our hen house, Mark.
Thank you, Marianne. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you. And one of the reasons is because you are such an avid animal activist. Are you really the activist's activist? You have written books about just the most awful things that happen to animals. You have looked into just dire things. You have also written on how to be a good activist, how to change the world. And now you have written a book that is really a departure. It's a charming book. It's sweet. It's kind of a love letter to some animals in some ways. And so what caused this change?
Well, thank you for that introduction and those kind comments. I think that it was really the fact that I had written some of these books that are difficult to read, that contain a lot of information about animal cruelty. I wanted, as you put it, to write a love letter to rabbits. I've always loved rabbits. I love how gentle they are. I love that they're herbivores. And I have always been fascinated by what they represent, such as magic and abundance and creativity and rebirth. But it wasn't until I adopted a rabbit that I came to understand anything about their complex inner lives, about the things that make rabbits, rabbits. I was also surprised that for such a popular animal, there are not very many nonfiction books written about them. And most of what has been written focuses on how they're exploited. So after knowing a number of rabbits personally, I thought it was time for a book that celebrates their history and their personalities and their spirits. So that's why I wrote The Way of the Rabbit. I call it an affectionate history of nature's most surprising species.
Yeah, and there were so many surprises in there. I just never really think about rabbits that much. Though, before we go any further, I think we should get the terminology straight, because you talk about lagomorphs a lot in the book, a word I've never heard before. And tell us what lagomorphs encompass, and also explain the difference between a rabbit and a hare. I've heard of both, but I don't think I ever knew really what a hare was.
Sure. Well, lagomorphs, that's kind of a scientific name for this group of mammals. So we have, beneath the lagomorph term, there are two families. There's the Acatonidae family, and that covers the a mammal called the pika, which is a small, cute little guy with small ears, and they live at high altitude. And you'll probably never see one in the wild unless you happen to be up in the mountains. And the other are the Laparotidae. And that family covers hares and rabbits. And to back up a little bit, you know, rabbits used to be considered rodents. But in 1912, scientists discovered that there are some differences between rodents and what they call then lagomorphs. And that include these pegged teeth, these little teeth behind the incisors in rabbits, and also this series of what's called fenestration. These whole lattice-like holes in the skull to lighten the skeleton. So after 1912, we no longer consider rabbits rodents. But they are, in a way, related to hares. There are some differences. They're not the same species. And hares and rabbits do a lot of things in nature that are different. For example, rabbits, for the most part, I should say, they give birth underground in burrows. An exception to that would be the eastern cottontail. But for the most part, they give birth underground, and the babies are essentially blind and deaf at birth. Their eyes are sealed shut for about 10 to 12 days. Their ears are closed. Whereas in the wild, hares give birth to babies called leverets, and these babies are basically ready to go. They're ready to run. They're ready to be independent as soon as they're born.
They all come from, started out in Spain, is that right?
Well,
I don't want to get into too much scientific stuff, but I learned so much about rabbits reading this book. I want that,
right.
That kind of surprised me, because I thought they were everywhere, and maybe they are now. But
well, they are almost everywhere in the modern sense. Yeah, they started off in the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal. They originated about 55 to 34 million years ago in Asia, and they eventually made their way over to North America, to Europe, to other continents, but what we're talking about in terms of the Iberian Peninsula is the European rabbit, Oryctolagus caniculus is their scientific name. And the reason that they're still around and so popular is because of the ancient Romans. They at the time, Spain was considered part of what we call now the Roman Empire. And they loved these rabbits. They loved how easy they were to tame. They kept them in landscaped parks. And they brought them to just about everywhere that the Romans were. They sailed all over, and it's because of the Romans, biologists believe, that Oryctolagus caniculus, the European rabbit, did not go extinct. Now, one thing I should note is that every single domesticated rabbit today is a descendant of the European rabbit, of that wild rabbit.
So you write a lot about rabbits and hares, mostly about rabbits, but you also, I mean, a lot of the book is really not about rabbits themselves, but it's about humans and how they interact with these animals and the whole cultural history. And there's so much. And these animals are such an integral part of human culture. And I just never really thought about it a lot. They played such a role in mythology, literature, art. So they've really been central animals for humans, haven't they?
Yeah, they really have. And surprisingly, it hasn't been that long that we have lived with them as companions. You know, even though I don't go into detail about how rabbits are exploited in the book, I do mention that they started off as farmed animals. And that's probably how we first began to see them as companions. You know, it was probably some child, a son or daughter of a farmer who decided that they liked this particular rabbit on the farm and wanted to have the rabbit as a, what we, some people call a pet. And it kind of developed from there. And it's only been in the last few decades that our relationships with rabbits as household companions has really flourished, because before, you know, they were relegated to a backyard hutch. They lived in a cage. Unfortunately, that's still the case for many rabbits today. But with the House Rabbit Society in the 1980s and other groups that have been advocating for rabbits as household companions, their status in the house has really grown, and people have learned what the rabbit is like. They've learned about their personalities. Whereas before, you know, if they're living in the backyard in a hutch, you don't understand those rabbits, that rabbit's needs. You don't understand what their personalities are like. But when they're living in the house, maybe even alongside a dog or cat, you can see how much affection these animals have, and they can use a litter box. They know their name. They play with toys. So all these other things.
No, I have to warn people going forward in this interview that I after reading this book, I really wanted rabbits. And that will probably happen to you too. Well, my friend Jeannie had two rabbits when I was little. And, you know, of course, that was a really long time ago. But they were in the hutch in the backyard. And I never thought of it as sad. You know, you accept so much when you're a child that this is the way things are. I wish I had been the one to say, no, they should be in the house. But I wasn't. But of course, that's obvious now. But it's also obvious that you say it started, they started as food animals, but they're still food. I mean, they're exploited probably in more different ways than any other animal.
Yeah. Yeah. That's unfortunate, but that's true. Yes.
So they're food animals, they're laboratory animals, they're performing animals, they're just everything.
Yeah, they're even exploited for the pet industry. So yeah, which is sort of
right.
Ironic.
Yeah. Just because we're talking about companion animals doesn't mean there's not exploitation. But as I was saying before, that you also talk a lot about just the important role they've played in New York in human history. Just wanted to talk a little bit about the Easter Bunny. I mean, a bunny I've thought about a lot, because I have always, well, not always, but for the maybe past 6 or 7 years, just loved the story of the dramatic goddess Istra and the connection of that holiday with all of these obvious fertility symbols like bunnies and eggs. And I always thought that was just gospel. And you destroyed my dream, Mark. You destroyed it. Like, it's kind of made up, isn't it? That's not really the history. And we're not as sure of the history of the Easter Bunny as I had thought. But tell us the Easter story.
Well, there are a number of theories about how the rabbit came to be associated with Easter. One has to do with this spring goddess. I think it's pronounced Yoster, not positive. But
oh,
I
yeah,
think
I'm
it's
sure.
Yoster.
I totally made it up. So yeah, I'm sure you're right.
But I'm not great. I'm sure I'll offend a lot of biologists when I say, even saying Oryctolagus caniculus. But anyway, she apparently had this cult in early Britain, and apparently her sacred animal was the rabbit or the hare. And the most reliable evidence we have for the existence of Yoster worship is from a Benedictine monk named Bede, B-E-D-E. Who wrote about her in the 8th century, but he makes no mention of her with any rabbits or hares or any other animals. And in fact, the more reliable connection between Yoster and logomorphs occurs in the late 19th century, when we find a legend in which the goddess turns a bird into a hare, thus explaining how this little mammal might be able to lay eggs. Another theory, and one that I think makes more sense, is connected to the English countryside, which is home to both hares and these birds called lapwings. And lapwings make their nests in a shallow depression in the soil, and hares do this as well. And it's not uncommon for the two species to borrow each other's nests. So it's easy to imagine someone walking along, disturbing a hare on a nest, watching that hare run away, and then finding a clutch of eggs in the nest. And from there, people just make the connection.
All right. Well, I'm still telling my story every Easter. I think every Easter I talk about it on the podcast, and I don't know what to do now. But this is just symbolic of the fact that this book is full of ways in which rabbits have played a role in human culture. Can you just maybe tell us some of your other favorite rabbit stories in fact or fiction? One of the ones, obviously, that I think we all know about is Beatrix Potter.
Yeah, Beatrix Potter is probably the person most aligned and connected to rabbits as companions in the 19th century. She's famous for writing the Tale of Peter Rabbit, which was based on rabbits that she kept as companions in her home in England. And she was able to really chart a course for her life in a way that women in the late 19th century, early 20th century weren't able to do. But because she was such a popular writer and illustrator and her books did so well, she was able to buy a farm in England and was kind of just her own person in a way that unfortunately women weren't allowed to be at the time. But Peter Rabbit was published in the early part of the 20th century. It became hugely popular. She was also not only very talented, but also very clever. And she merchandised Peter Rabbit into dolls and games. And he became a household name. And we still know him today. Unfortunately, he's been pirated a lot by other writers and other companies, but he's still immensely popular.
And I found it particularly stunning. As I said, I was so astounded by the fact that Rabbit's played such a role. Obviously, Peter Rabbit is a beloved character. I remember him from my own childhood. And how do you explain how people have, for so long, incorporated rabbits into their culture, given them these symbolic meanings, had symbolic rabbits who were very beloved, and yet have been so cruel to actual real rabbits? I mean, I'm kind of asking you the fundamental question of animal rights, but I'm always interested in your thoughts on it.
Well, we're hypocrites, right? I mean, we look at an animal like the rabbit who has so many qualities we admire. We admire their speed. We admire their strength. We admire almost in a way their invisibility because, you know, we get glimpses of them, but we don't see them in the wild that clearly or that often. And at the same time, we exploit things that we admire. We exploit those qualities. I think part of it might have started off, you know, consuming rabbits because we wanted to ingest some of those qualities. This is not part of the book. I'm speculating, but I'm guessing that that could be one of the reasons why. And we also, because they are so abundant, you know, we see them as a resource for clothing. And unfortunately for animal testing, because they're so docile. And yeah, we're just, there's no good answer, unfortunately, Marianne, at least from my point of view, on why we do this. I just wanted to write a book maybe to help change that course a little bit, to help explain why these animals are so important and why they're so different and why they're so wonderful. And maybe, you know, if one person who eats rabbits or wears rabbit fur or exploits rabbits in some other way, picks up the book, reads it, and decides, I don't think I can do this anymore, then I'll consider that a huge victory.
Yeah, I think that people too, it's important to remember that, you know, I've never eaten a rabbit and it's not that common in the States, but rabbits are, they're factory farmed, right?
They are. They're factory farmed.
I know this isn't what you cover in the book, but I kind of can't help but go there.
Yeah, no, there are, especially in countries like France, we do have it in the United States to a smaller extent. But yes, unfortunately, it's very sad, but they are factory farmed.
Yeah. One of the most well-known pieces of literature, I think, about rabbits is Watership Down. I read it when it first came out, so that was a long time ago, but I loved it. And it's an unusual book. I mean, unlike most books with animal characters, Richard Adams, the author, said he was setting out to portray rabbits authentically while still making them, you know, comprehensible to humans by allowing them speech. I mean, it's rabbitified speech a bit, but basically
right.
Speech. And so do you think this was a success? Does this accurately portray how rabbits live? Is it wildly anthropomorphic and just gets everything wrong? Is it good for rabbits, bad for rabbits? Did you love it?
I think it's good for rabbits if it makes people sympathetic toward rabbits. And if we could back up a little bit and explain why Richard Adams wrote the book, you know, he was inspired by a biologist, a naturalist named Ronald Lockley, who observed rabbits for about 2 or 3 years in a special environment that he created. It was a very large environment, but he wrote a book called The Private Life of the Rabbit after that, which came out in the early 60s. And Richard Adams was very inspired by this work and wanted to create something similar, but as a work of fiction, and as he called it, just a story about rabbits for his daughters. And I think that there's a lot about the book that is accurate in terms of how the story reflects animals. They are courageous. They do fight, unfortunately. They do battle one another from time to time. And they're victims of a lot of harassment and a lot of abuse. So I think those parts of the story are very accurate.
Yeah, and I mean, anthropomorphism is always such a difficult question. Like, we are limited in our ability to understand other animals. We are limited to our own experiences.
Right.
We kind of have to apply them.
Right. There was a movement in the early 20th century by authors such as Jack London, probably the most famous, where he would take a story about an animal and really anthropomorphize it in a way that made the reader feel for that animal. And there was an author I mentioned in the book who wrote a story about a cottontail rabbit, and the author's name was Ernest Thompson Seton. And he was accused of being a nature faker. He was called on for using his own imagination to portray how these rabbits felt and acted and what their motivations were. And unfortunately, that changed his writing. You know, he decided not to pursue that type of writing anymore. But I think it's important that we have these types of fictionalized, anthropomorphized versions of animals so that they really help us see animals in a different way, even if they're not 100% accurate.
Yeah, I don't see how they could be 100% accurate. It's just arrogant to suppose that we could do that. There's a certain amount we can know, as long as they can get as close as possible. You know, obviously there are things that are ridiculously anthropomorphized, where animals are just standing in for human children, and they're not really trying to portray animals at all. But if they're trying, I mean, he used his imagination because that's all we've got. I mean,
right.
We're never going to fully understand what's going on in a rabbit's brain.
Absolutely. And I think the same argument could be made about Peter Rabbit. You know, here was a rabbit who wears a coat and shoes, and his mother makes tea, and they live in a house decorated with pictures on the walls. That's nothing like what a real rabbit would live like. However, in his behavior, in his anatomy, he is very much a rabbit. You know, he runs on all fours, he gets into mischief, but
he does eat the garden, which is one of the major points of contention between humans and rabbits.
That's true. Yes, he does.
It occurred to me when you were talking about eating them before, that might have been one of the reasons that people started eating them. But people will eat anything, so why am I even looking for a reason?
Yeah.
All right, let's get a little bit into your own story. You mentioned before that you always were drawn to rabbits. I'd like to know a little bit more about why that would be, if there is any more, or maybe it just happened. And then I want to hear about your rabbit experiences.
Okay, well, I don't think I have a great explanation for the early part of why I loved rabbits so much.
You just liked them. That's fine.
The sense I have now, and I mentioned in the book, is I felt a real kinship with them. And I don't think I understood that when I was a child. I never had a companion rabbit when I was a child, but I really loved stories about rabbits. I really loved cartoons with rabbits. When I would watch something like Winnie the Pooh, or read Winnie the Pooh, or see a story that had a rabbit, if it had a rabbit in it, that was my number one, that was my favorite character. And then as I got older, and when I became an ethical vegan in 2001, I turned to rabbits because I realized they are symbols of veganism. You know, they're used on labels to show that a product is vegan. They are herbivores themselves. And so it became a natural extension of my ethical veganism to start volunteering at sanctuaries where they had rabbits. And I eventually started volunteering for an organization in the Bay Area in California called Save a Bunny. And they said that one of the best things I could do would be to foster a rabbit. So I brought a rabbit home and promptly fell in love with this little guy, and was asked to foster another rabbit who happened to be a female, and they bonded. And I just ended up adopting him, and I ended up adopting every rabbit I fostered, and plus a couple others, and it was ridiculous. And I just realized I couldn't let my empathy and love for animals, plus my fondness for rabbits specifically, get in the way of of this. And that's not really the great explanation, but I just had this tremendous fondness that I couldn't explain, and I adopted more, and eventually they passed away, And in 2013, our rabbit Sophie died. And at that point, Lauren, my wife, and I talked about not having any more animals because it's just so painful. And that's the way we lived for a number of years. And then a few weeks ago, we were on a walk in our neighborhood and we found a couple of rabbits who had been abandoned. They were probably given as an Easter present. And somebody just decided that, the novelty had worn off and it was too much work, and they just let them go in a neighborhood. And we scooped them up and we brought them home. And unfortunately, very, very sadly, the female didn't make it. The female died. She didn't survive her spay surgery. But the little, when I say little, I say because they were both about 6 months old. The male, he's a New Zealand white, absolutely full of beans, loaded with personality. He's running around the apartment now. And to be honest, Marianne, Lauren and I are having a discussion on what we're going to do, because this little rabbit has been through so much already. He was abandoned. He was living on the street. He was traumatized by us rescuing him. He then went through major surgery and then he lost his mate. And do we then turn him over to another family? Because technically we're fostering him too. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I know that it's very, very painful for me, but that's my relationship with rabbits. I just love them so much.
Yeah. I want you to keep him. One of my next question actually was going to be, I mean, you had mentioned at the end of the book that you didn't have rabbits, and I was wondering whether that had changed, and apparently it has just changed. I mean, I'm all for you keeping the rabbit, as, everybody's always in favor of everybody adopting animals, but you do seem to have such a special place in your heart for them. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to have a rabbit? Like, I've never really known a rabbit. I've had lots of dogs. I've had cats. Other people I know have had dogs and cats, but it maybe like really small animals I've been around a bit, but I've never really been around a rabbit.
They are wonderful companions, but they're also more work than dogs and cats for a couple of reasons. Number one, because they're prey animals, they do not like to be picked up. They do not show when they're sick. They don't regurgitate. When they are not feeling well, their chances are they're just going to hold it in. So you have to learn to look for certain signs. If they're not using the litter box, if they're not moving, the size and shape of their fecal pellets, that type of thing. The other thing that makes it difficult is that they're diggers, they're chewers. In nature, they dig burrows, they chew on vines, and they will do that in your house. And so, not that you have vines or dirt in your house, but you have expensive charging cords and you have nice furniture. And I can't tell you how many phone calls back in the day when phones were connected to a wire that we've been disconnected because Sophie or some other bunny decided that, oh, that was the perfect little vine to snip through. So you need to educate yourself about how to bunny-proof your home, not only because you don't want to be losing your expensive charging cords, but you also don't want to put that rabbit's life in danger because they chew through something electric, and that could be a big problem. Having said that, those caveats aside, they're amazing animals. They are very affectionate. The little rabbit, I keep calling him the little rabbit or the male rabbit because I have yet to name, we're avoiding naming him because we're worried about bonding with him. But he has learned how to jump on the couch. He just loves exploring. We've gradually given him more space in the apartment as we've been able to bunny-proof each room. And they're just delightful. They're fun to watch. They love to be petted. They love to be talked to. They don't necessarily, as I said before, they don't love being picked up. But some do. Some don't mind it at all. And they also need to be, cared for in some ways, like dogs and cats. They need regular vet appointments, but it has to be with a vet who considers it a specialty.
Yeah. No, I'm sure they're different. Well, I'm rooting for this little guy, but I know that if you can't keep him, that he will still find a wonderful home. How hard is it to adopt a rabbit? Can you kind of find one in any shelter? Are they that common now?
They are especially common in the few months after Easter. So April, May, June, those are the months that you'll find them for the most part in shelters. Rescue centers are full of rabbits. I contacted a rabbit rescue group shortly after we found these two in the neighborhood. And the woman told me they have almost 200 rabbits right now in this little shelter where she works. So they're everywhere. And I'll take this opportunity to say, please do adopt if you want a rabbit. More and more states, thankfully, are outlawing the sale of rabbits in pet stores. But if you decide, you know, if you live in an area where you can find one in a pet store, please don't. Please save a life. Please adopt from your local shelter or your animal rescue group, your rabbit rescue group.
Yeah, and I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast would already do that. But I noticed that you made a point throughout the book of slipping that in and just kind of gently slipping in some other ideas about breeding and how they should be cared for. So do you feel that even though when we started out, we said this is not really an activist book, do you feel like it's a very soft-pedaled activist book that that is going to reach a broader audience of people who just care about rabbits or interested in rabbits, but will have those hints in it of the right thing to do?
Marianne, I will let you in on a little secret. That is exactly my hope. It is a subversive book. I want people to pick it up not thinking that it's an animal rights book, because in essence, it's not. I mean, it does talk about the rights of rabbits and other animals, but it's really a book that celebrates rabbits. But when you read between the lines and you see those subtle remarks, you know, I mentioned that nobody needs a rabbit's foot except a rabbit, that type of stuff. Yeah, I'm hoping that people will see that it is about how rabbits need to be cared for in a way that an animal rights book would, but in a softer way.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a great concept because people love animals. They just are horrible to them. So hopefully you will reach those people who love rabbits, but don't really know what that means in the real world. The other thing I noticed about the book is that this is an insanely researched book. I mean, when you do something, you really do it. And how much research did you put into it? And how do you go about that process of writing? You settled on the idea and, you know, you had this idea of it being a subversive book, but that meant that you had to like go into a lot of stuff that was sort of side issues just for people who are interested in rabbits. Tell us a little bit about your process.
Well, fortunately, I am hugely curious. I love history books. I love archaeology. And so it's very easy fit for me to take a subject like rabbits and then expand on that. So I spent 2 years doing research. I interviewed biologists and archaeologists and paleontologists and art historians and mythologists and, you know, scholars from all over the world who had different specialties. For example, I talked to a person in England whose specialty is very narrow. His specialty is drolleries, these little bits of marginalia in Middle Ages, medieval manuscripts, right? So just because rabbits are used as a subject in these drolleries. So I had a great time finding these people. Basically, you know, I read a lot, and because I've been an animal advocate and especially a rabbit advocate for so long, I did have contacts in that society, in that world, and I was able to find, like, I guess you could say reports, you know, books, other books, you know, very arcane in some ways, reports and surveys about rabbits, and I would find the name of an archaeologist, or I would find the name of a biologist, and I would reach out to that person. You know, thankfully, we have social media and the internet these days. You can find almost anybody online. And these people were so generous to me with their time. I am so grateful to these people who were so excited that somebody was asking them a question about their specialty. And it wasn't another, you know, it wasn't a professor or it wasn't a student. It was somebody who was writing a book about something that they found meaning in. So it was very easy. It was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be.
I can imagine. Like when you were saying about this expert in drolleries, like how excited must he have been to be interviewed for a mainstream audience publication,
right,
about this specialty, which nobody right. even knows what it is. So I can imagine I'm so excited that you did that and you brought together this information. Because as you said, for some reason, I would have imagined that there were gazillions of books about rabbits, because there's gazillions of books about, you know, any animal that is a companion animal. But you pointed out that there just isn't.
There's not. And it's funny because there's all these books about animals who are not companion animals. I went to several bookstores when I was doing research just to satisfy my own curiosity to see how few books there are about rabbits. And there were tons of books about dogs and cats, tons of books about horses, tons of books about whales, and books about insects, and books about animals that we would never dream of having in our home. If there was a book about rabbits, it was a book about how to breed them, or a book about maybe how they're exploited for fur or something. And so it solidified in my mind that we really needed a book that celebrates rabbits. Now, I should say there's a wonderful book out there called Stories Rabbits Tell by Margot DeMello and Susan Davis. And anybody who loves rabbits probably already knows about this book, but it's like the other books. It goes into exquisite detail about how rabbits are exploited. However, a book like that, a book like Stories Rabbits Tell, is important. You know, we need to have this information. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have these books. I'm just saying that I wanted to create a different kind of book, a book that a sensitive rabbit lover like myself could sit down with and enjoy and not worry about, oh, the next page there's going to be some horrible text or horrible image of the animal I love most being harmed. That's exactly, I wanted to avoid that.
No, and I really appreciated it because, you know, a lot of the books I sit down to read to prepare for interviews are hard. It's difficult to get through it sometimes. And this was just a sheer joy. Before I let you go, I just want to ask you about one other character who I've heard his name, though I didn't know how to pronounce it and didn't really know anything about him, but that's William Cowper, who was apparently a fairly famous poet. And I just loved him. Can you tell people about him?
Yeah, William Cowper was an 18th century poet, and he was a bit of a grump. He was a bit of a curmudgeon, and he had a number of animals in his home. And apparently there were some neighbor kids in England who decided they wanted to cheer him up a little bit. So they brought him a baby hare, a leveret, one day. And after a while, he had two more of these little hares. And he just loved these little animals so much that he wrote poems about them. And I would never advocate, and I mentioned this in the book, I would never advocate that anybody bring home a hare as a companion, but people did it. And William Cowper is one of those examples. He was also an abolitionist and wrote some other literature that we would consider animal rights literature today. He was against trophy hunting. So here's this great poet of his day, who's this, as I said, a curmudgeon, yet he's got this huge soft spot for animals. I list at one point the tally of different animals he had in his home at one time, with rabbits and dogs and cats and birds. And not all of them, as I say, I would recommend having, but still there he was with all these animals, this menagerie in his home. And they were in his home. They were living in cages in the backyard. Right.
No, that was the thing that I totally loved about it. His home just sounded so delightful, though it would require a lot of cleaning, but really delightful. And it's for those who want to look into him, it's Cowper, which is probably making a lot of people think right now, oh yeah, I've heard of him, but it's pronounced Cooper. Yeah, I love that story. And I love I love hearing those stories that show that those of us who care about animals have always been there and always tried. And perhaps now we are sufficiently or becoming sufficiently organized so that we can make a little bit more of a dent in how animals are treated. And of course, you are one of the people who's always doing that. I'm so grateful for your work, Mark. It's really a gift. And thank you for that and for this book and for writing a book that was so easy to read and taught me so much about an animal. And I rest my case that rabbits are so important. And yet, from what you were saying about no books being written about them, they're so important in so many aspects of society, literature, mythology, history, and yet they're so overlooked. So they are overlooked no more. Thanks, Mark.
Well, thank you, Marianne. I hope this does make an impression in the rabbit literature and in the rabbit community.
Yes, I'm sure it will.
Jasmine here. We're so excited to announce the upcoming release of the groundbreaking new book, Anti-Racism in Animal Advocacy, Igniting Cultural Transformation, published by Lantern Books and Media. Inspired by Encompass's racial equity trainings, this collection of essays was written by farmed animal protection leaders, myself included, who are committed to exploring and prioritizing racial equity as we work to create a more effective and just animal protection movement. We wish to document our stories and processes in an exploratory space from which we can grow and use our words to hold ourselves and our peers accountable, ultimately creating new paths forward. I'm lucky enough to be the editor of the book. The only way to be an effective animal activist is to prioritize anti-racism within our advocacy. This essay collection will provide a new, necessary way forward. Anti-racism in animal advocacy, igniting cultural transformation, is new as of September 2021 and is a collaboration between Our Henhouse, Encompass, Sentient Media, and Lantern Books and Media. And we've got even more exciting news. Our Henhouse is honored to roll out an audio series of the book, launching this October 2021. Narrated by the essay authors themselves, the four-part series will air every Thursday throughout October. This will be in addition to our regular podcast schedule, of course. We cannot wait to share it with you. To find out more about the book and to pre-order it, visit encompassmovement.org/book. That's encompassmovement.org/book.
Anxieties are rising. The first of our stories highlighting exactly how high anxieties are rising within the meat industry. This was sent to me by Allison Cole, and I really thank her for it, though it was a burden to read it. Even simple things draw animal rights activists' hatred. This is from Ag Daily, and this is from a column by Farm Babe. That's what she calls herself because she thinks she's a babe. I assume that's why she calls herself that. This is how it starts. Exploit, torture, murder, rape, slavery, abuse. How awful are these words? How terrible are these actions? And what do these words all have in common? These are words that vegan animal rights activists use to describe the work of livestock farmers. Isn't that sad? All right, let's go back over those words. Exploit. Well, that one's pretty obvious. Torture, hard to deny. Murder, unless you're going to say that word doesn't apply to animals, like what else would you call it? Rape. Yeah, slavery, abuse. That pretty much sums it up, doesn't it? But not according to Farm Babe. She thinks it's crazy to think that these are the words I must block to prevent harassment from animal rights activists on my page on Facebook. Although it's quite rare I am attacked. maybe because nobody's paying attention to you except me. I'm paying attention to you. But I'm not harassing you on your Facebook page. I'm not, and I don't intend to. So then she talks about this video that went viral, which is this picture of these cows pushing their heads through the bars, about, I think there were three of them, to lick this kitty, this little cat. I mean, just heartbreaking, really. But, you know, beautiful in its own way, but heartbreaking. Well, she loved it. She thought it was just sweet. How can a video this adorable upset anyone? How do their minds go to a level so negative? We must remember that there's an extremely good chance they have never been to or worked on a farm a day in their life. She is, of course, referring to all of the comments from the animal rights activists who were like, so sad about this picture, at the same time recognizing, I'm sure, that it was so sweet. But they claim these cows are about to go to slaughter. That's not true. Then she points out that these are young calves. No, we're near the end of their days. Oh, good. We're going to let them live for how much longer? And say that they're missing their moms? No. Get this. Holstein calves and cows in general tend to be lickers by nature. They're a more friendly and curious breed and are known to be not the best mothers. Oh my God. Oh my God. Can you imagine these people who take these babies away from these cows? Cows who, like, are pretty much accepted as being among the best mothers in the business. And I don't mean the agriculture business. I mean the world business. I mean life. She's saying they're not the best mothers. Maybe that's because you take their babies away from them. That would make, you know, that would like ruin my motherhood instincts.
But, you know, of course, the animal activists are just like making up all of this stuff. They say bad things about animal agriculture, even though they don't just do it for profit. Quote, if you want profits, you want these animals as happy and healthy as possible. They're still dragging out that one. Unbelievable. She has been asked, how can they raise an animal only to know that it will die? But you know what? My train of thought is that everything dies. We must treat every living being with the utmost respect, regardless of its purpose. I love the cattle as much as the cat. They will both die someday. But the difference? Cattle come with recipes. Get it? Oh, my God. You know, the other difference might be is that we don't kill the cat. Well, you probably do. But, you know, or like other living beings, there are many living beings, including ourselves. We don't actually murder them. So that's the difference. We actually kill the cattle. And of course, they come with recipes. She also points out that livestock gives thousands of useful byproducts. And yes, they will someday be let go of, just like pets and humans are. Like, that's not exactly what we do to pets and humans, is it? Let go of them. Of course, she hates the word slaughter. Why is it when it's time for pets to die, society uses gentle phrases like putting them to sleep, but livestock are, quote, slaughtered? Who even came up with these terms? The word slaughter just sounds awful. But is the process really awful? I would say no. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. All right, I can't talk about it anymore. It's like making me insane. Okay. Our next story is from, what website is this from? I think it's from Drovers. It's by Brandy Buzzard. And Dear Richard Branson, what's worse, a rocket or a steak? Now, it's interesting that Brandy is upset about, you know, one of the things I'm upset about, too. She's talking about Richard Branson, owner of Virgin Media. And she says, someone with so much money can literally burn it. And if she was like him, she could just board her own rocket plane and launch it to space for the heck of it. Who cares about the environment, rocket fuel, the ozone layer, or climate change, right? Well, you know, I'm with her there. I hate to see this horrible waste of fossil fuels in these billionaire expeditions. But what she's really upset is the fact that this is the same Richard Branson who spouted this nonsense, why I've given up eating beef. That was a article from Richard Branson. And as she points out, Richard Branson has publicly stated numerous times he gave up eating beef and meat for environmental reasons. And so she's really upset about how hypocritical it is that somebody who supposedly cares about the environment enough to unnecessarily, which she says is a healthy, sustainable protein, and then he can just launch a rocket plane. Well, you know, I agree with that, but is it really a good idea for you to be pointing out that it's hypocritical for him to be criticizing one form of waste of and climate change contributor in favor of another? I don't, like, have we thought this through? She does go through all, you know, the nonsense that they constantly say the cattle are responsible for only 2% of greenhouse gas emissions. American agriculture is only responsible for 10%. You know, look at the real numbers, folks. This is really getting to be one of their big talking points. You know, she's always loved Richard Branson. He had the money to go to space, so he did. Bravo. That's the kind of attitude I am generally 100% supportive of. Live your life. Hey, I bet that really is the attitude that she generally has, except when it implies that it's criticizing raising cattle. So these are what people who are concerned about climate change should really do. Reduce your food waste. Well, that's a good idea. Reduce your reliance on single-use plastics. Last time I looked, I think every little tiny broken up muscle of a dead cow, chopped up muscles, was encased in single-use plastics. But, you know, whatever. Park the car and walk. Okay. Or take public transport. Take public transport is a is she really saying that you're going to save the planet by parking the car and then walking part of the distance to where, like, that makes a lot of sense. All right, Brandy. Really, really not too impressed. All right. Our final story here is a little different because this is from desmog.com, which is a website, if you're not familiar with it, which kind of tries to break open the lies of environmental polluters and toxic, you know, people who are spewing toxic gases into our atmosphere. And it does a great job. And it, And they recently did this investigation, and it's on their website. I mean, this is much longer than I can talk about right here, but I highly recommend reading it. How the meat industry is climate washing its polluting business model. And she points out that anxieties are rising. That's not exactly the language she uses, but she's talking about a speech made by Xin Huang, who is the Secretary General of the International Meat Secretariat. Well, that sounds fancy, doesn't it? Huang's speech points to an industry nervous about its role in a carbon-constrained future. So what the meat industry has done is develop a, quote, multi-pronged PR strategy that seeks to legitimize not only the industry's current activities, but also its plans to scale up production, despite clear warnings from scientists that this could scupper efforts to meet climate targets. People are unbelievable, aren't they? Of course, we've been keeping track of some of this PR, and now it's clear that there's a concerted effort. This is how the industry is seeking to portray itself as a climate leader. These are the strategies: downplaying the impact of livestock farming on the climate, casting doubt on the efficacy of alternatives to meat to combat climate change, promoting the health benefits of meat while overlooking the industry's environmental footprint, exaggerating the potential of agricultural innovations to reduce the livestock industry's ecological impact. And yes, we have seen pretty much all of this. She also talks about this recent study from NYU by Jennifer Jacquet, who has, of course, been on the podcast. And it looked how meat companies could blow through the climate targets of their countries of origin. One example of that is the EU's largest pork producer is Danish Crown. And it's set to consume 42% of Denmark's emissions budget under the Paris Agreement by 2030. That's not going to work. What are they supposed to do? Turn off all the lights and have no heat? It's Denmark. It's chilly. At a virtual conference in March, the Animal Agriculture Alliance, our favorites, a U.S.-based industry group, announced plans to, quote, change the narrative and position animal agriculture as a solution to reducing our environmental footprint and improving our planet for generations to come. So they're not just planning on lying. They're, like, hiding what they're doing. They're planning on trying to turn it around and look like they're actually doing good. And just by coincidence, right after I decided to talk about that article for Rising Anxieties, I saw on the Meeting Place blog a guest blog by Juliana Potts, who is the president and CEO of the North American Meat Institute, talking about their new protein pact. It's their new PR strategy. She starts off by saying, producing the meat, poultry, and dairy we need while using less land, water, and energy has never been more important. And so they have put together this pact to deliver safe, nutritious meat, poultry, and dairy, balanced diets, good jobs, and thriving communities, to provide the most humane care and raise healthy animals, to protect the land, air, and water we all use. Oh my God. Yeah. It's just all, like, it's all just loathsome PR. And we know better than anybody. If they're talking about protecting the land, air, and water, as well as they provide humane care to animals, well, we're all in a lot of trouble. This is getting serious, folks. They're, you know, people want to believe this. They want to believe anything the meat industry tells them. That's the whole key to what's going on. Now the planet is at risk. And that's it for this week's Rising Anxieties.
Well, that's it for this week's show. As always, if you like the podcast, and if you're able, you can support us by joining the flock at ourhenhouse.org/donate for $10 a month or $100 a year, or you can make whatever donation you're comfortable with.
Another great way to support us is to leave a fabulous review wherever you listen to podcasts or on Apple Podcasts, or you can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or Instagram at ourhenhouse. If you shop on Amazon, you can use Amazon Smile using Our Hen House as your favored charity. And of course, tell your friends about us.
If you're one of our listeners who already supports us, thank you so much. I'm Jasmine Singer. Thank you to my co-host, Marianne Sullivan.
That's me.
And to Jen Riley for her work in producing this podcast, and to composer Michael Herron for the music. Thanks to Jocelyn Martinez for her work doing research, and for Eric Montgomery of Podcast Haven for his work editing. Thanks to Lori Johnston of Two Trick Pony for her graphic design services.
We will be back next week with a brand new show, so don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you are a Flock member, remember to check your email or the Flock Facebook page on Tuesday for your bonus content.
Thanks so much for tuning in and for changing the world for animals.